Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about the single biggest and least mentioned place that U.S. tax dollars are going. Our guest, Stephen Semler, is a senior fellow at Center for International Policy and author of Polygraph, a newsletter on Substack, which you can find at stephensemler.com, and which I highly recommend for the words and for the wonderful graphics and charts that are there. Stephen Semler, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thanks for having me, David. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for the work you've been doing. Let's talk about the federal budget and what I think, tell me if I'm wrong, is the least talked about but biggest piece of it. What's the pie chart?
The Pentagon as a department is the biggest piece of it already of Trump's budget request. He requested $960 billion, but if you include the military spending that falls outside of the specific department of the Pentagon, including nuclear weapons activities in Department of Energy, FBI counterterrorism unit, certain elements within the Department of Homeland Security, you get a military budget of over $1 trillion he's proposing. And that includes his regular budget request and that big, beautiful bill he's talking about that's separate from it that'll be passed through a process called reconciliation along party lines that includes funding for it too. So Trump is basically proposing that we spend as much as we did on average between 1942 and 1945, which seems inappropriate given we're not fighting, you know, Nazi Germany and, you know, the Imperial Japanese, you know, Navy in the Pacific.
So adjusted for inflation, this would top Obama's post-World War II record and approximate what was happening during World War II.
Once the adjustment figures come up for 2026, it should be, the numbers I said are still correct, but it should be around the same height as during those 2 years, I think 2009, 2010, where we had 100,000 troops in both Iraq and Afghanistan waging illegal wars there. So we're not really in great company historically in terms of this budget request.
No, not for a peace hero candidate, president. You made a pie chart, Stephen Semler, with the military chunk and also policing. And together, it was like three quarters of Trump's budget proposal, right?
Yeah, 76% to be exact, included the Pentagon, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and Veterans Affairs. So what we're looking at is the Pentagon budget proper. We're looking at the costs of war, which I view as represented, at least in the discretionary budget request, as Veterans Affairs. And then you have the security apparatus, which are now increasingly blurred with the military. Now, I mean, this has been going on for quite some time, but especially under Trump, of that these policing agencies, these federal policing agencies are now, the lines between them and the U.S. military are becoming increasingly blurred. The training, the militarized training has been around forever. I mean, especially since 9/11 and the transfer of military equipment to police forces has to those federal police agencies have been around too. I interpret this budget request as being a step towards the conservative vision of there's really no acceptable use of government except as a security apparatus, pretty much. And I see this not as a perfect representation, because obviously they're still talking about, you know, that one quarter that isn't related to military or police. But I see it as a pretty big step in that direction.
The nuclear weapons that are in the so-called Department of Energy, those in there too?
Yeah. That's, I included those into the broader Pentagon budget. But it's one thing I didn't realize, David, is how much of Department of Energy's budget goes to the Pentagon. It's like, it's two thirds. Which is wild.
It has no more to do with energy than the Pentagon has to do with defense.
Exactly.
This is just what we're supposed to call them. So the numbers you're using are basically the numbers that CPRI uses each year for the military spending of each country, right? And does comparisons among countries.
I'm unsure exactly what CPRI's methodology is. This sounds about right. I think they also include State Department military aid, which I wasn't able to include here just because the Trump's budget request didn't include that level of detail. But that just makes it's his State Department request even worse, really, because you know that military aid isn't being touched. So the huge cut he's requesting for State Department, which is I think north of 50 billion, is coming from all non-military programs. Now, coming from the humanitarian sector, a lot of these like development aid programs are really deranged and service really nefarious interests. But in terms of like, if I had to fund a certain set of programs within the State Department, I wouldn't choose the humanitarian ones first. Let's just put it that way.
You did a comparison recently, I think, between military spending and diplomacy. And I wasn't really aware the US was doing diplomacy. How did you calculate that, and what was the contrast?
That was the thing I had in my, that was the sarcastic comment I had replaying in my head as I was making the chart. It came from a reader. The request came from a reader, and I know other people have asked about it in the past, so I decided to make a chart. Basically, what I did is the annual State Department and International Programs bill, called State Foreign Operations and Related Programs, is an annual bill passed by Congress, part of the broader annual bill. I took that amount of money, adjusted for inflation, and I removed the military aid portion of it. So I was left with those so-called real or so-called diplomatic programs and real or so-called humanitarian development programs. But the purpose was just to compare, just to show the imbalance when it comes to US foreign policy of the Pentagon as an institution versus the State Department as an institution. I get what you're saying about the so-called diplomacy comment. Again, I agree with you. But I think that no, but actually, what I'm saying is, and is that people say that just fixing that imbalance, meaning bringing State Department's budget up closer to the Pentagon's budget, will fix or somehow demilitarize US foreign policy. But that's wrong, obviously. I think what's more important is that top line, that Pentagon budget, comes down more than State Department goes up.
Yes. Or State Department becomes independent and ceases to be an arm of the Pentagon. But
That's the thing. Like, where is the, there's so many different agreements, and you can look at major agreements or even smaller agreements on military aid. State Department is, it seems to be just an arm of a very militarized foreign policy, providing a nice face to it. I think one difference between the biggest difference between what Trump's budget request looks like and what Harris's would have looked like is that huge cut to the State Department. But at the same time, it'd be pushing an identical, nearly identical foreign policy, except I think it would be even less diplomatic in the Middle East. But I'm getting off track here.
but proposing to close embassies across Africa but keep military bases, I mean, forecloses the possibility of handling anything through discussion, through conversation. Like, it's just blow stuff up. That's the only possibility left.
That's a really important point. Your footprint, global footprint, is no longer diplomatic. It's just strictly military. And I think they view basically State Department as redundant when it comes to foreign policy. I think they just view the Pentagon as how you should interpret foreign policy, which means in a very unsophisticated and extremely militarized way, where you don't view the world as, a serious interaction between states and peoples. You view it just as sort of a technocratic battlefield, basically. And then you just weigh it like that, which is just a really dumb and extremely expensive way to run your foreign policy. But dumb policies are often profitable, so I think that's part of the reason why we're stuck with it.
Very true. So when you do compare this US military spending with other countries, I mean, everybody likes to look at the biggest and say it's as much as the next 10 or the next 11 or whatever. I like to look from the bottom up, and it's, as much as almost 200. It's as much as almost every country. If you leave maybe numbers 2, 3, and 4 out, it's as much as all the rest of them. How do you like to compare it to the rest of the world?
Those military to military comparisons about, like, the US spends more than the next 10 or something, are they seem to get a lot of traction. It's not the method I choose to run with usually. I kind of just do those comparisons because I know people want to hear about them. What's more interesting to me is comparing the Pentagon budget to countries' GDPs. So the Pentagon budget, in terms of value, is larger than Switzerland's GDP, larger than all but 20 countries. So I already choose to count countries. I mean, you're talking hundreds, like 150 countries or whatever, 160. We have a budget that's larger than all of those countries, which to me, why I like making that comparison is not just to, sound unique because no one else does it, but because it just shows what a waste it is. We have effectively an economy, an economy separate from our regular economy that could be put to any number of purposes that's state run, that isn't beholden to market forces. And I mean, obviously it is to some extent, but it's effectively a state run economy. It's a monopsony. There's a single buyer. What keeps me like from just drowning in cynicism when I'm looking at this stuff is like thinking about like the alternative possibilities of taking like an economy that's separate where we don't have to fight the climate crisis through the tax code, which is slow. I'm just thinking of like massive state investments in transportation, in infrastructure and environment, anything that's useful besides military would be so very much appreciated and so much just more interesting than this just tub of largesse we have now.
I like your comparison of the US military's dollar amount to other countries' entire economies. I don't like military spending as a percentage of an economy, and NATO dictating. I don't know if you saw this, our so-called Secretary of State has recently announced that all NATO countries will agree to get to 5% of their GDPs on their militaries, because I like actual dollar amounts or per capita, because it's how many people are there, and the US is at the top, except for Israel and maybe North Korea, we don't know. As a percentage of an economy, there's no limit, right? There's no reason it can't be 6%, 7%. They'll soon be demanding 8%. And there's no logic unless military spending is a public good and it should be maximized. And the richer you are, the more of it you should bestow upon the grateful world. It seems insane to me for us to, for not us, but everybody else to have shifted in obedience to NATO, it seems, to measuring military spending as a percentage of an economy.
You know what I'm seeing? I'm seeing that request blowing back. I don't know if you would call that colonial reflection or something, or some sort of very sophisticated term, but I'm seeing the demands in the US that the US peg its military budget to that 5% figure, usually from very highly compensated senators, compensated by the arms industry, like Roger Wicker. I think he's kind of at the forefront of this. It's a stupid concept. It's one that you see where usually, case studies of the Dunning-Kruger experiment or case studies like that sort of phenomenon, like the Matty Glaceses of the world, will say, well, the US isn't actually spending that much on its military because look, the percent of its GDP is, the military expenditures as percent of US GDP has been declining. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean the actual capital investment, what it actually enables, is declining. And pegging it to a percent of the economy is just, there's no other word for it. It's just really stupid. Like, would you peg a percent of your income to pants and shoes? No, because if you start earning more money, you don't, at a certain point, you just don't need any more pants and shoes. At a certain point, you would just start, I don't know, like if I had a huge increase in if I was following that rule and I had a huge increase in pay, what would I do? I would just have like a certain point where I'd just be buying chrome cowboy boots and chaps for no reason. I don't need them, but it's just I have so much money divested to this one thing that it's not based on any other external factors, just kind of this internal thing. I think what it represents is that there's, if I had to sum up the problem, really, it's that there's a performative link that's assumed between military spending and security, where those two things are saying, the more military spending we have, the better. It's like military spending is cash you shove into a vending machine, and if you shove enough into it, you get security that comes out. And you see that in official documents, like the 2018 National Defense Strategy said, the surest way to prevent war is to be prepared to win one through a constant investment in a quote, more lethal force, which is probably where Kamala Harris got that phrase from, that 2018 NDS that was authored by Mattis. And then you had Biden last term saying, describing his 2023 military budget request as the biggest investment in security in this country's history.
Right. Again, security, defense, these are the words you're supposed to use, but I don't see where is a report documenting that places that spend more on militaries get more safety? Because I haven't seen any. Maybe the opposite you could document, but
I
not
was going to say,
that.
I can point to many pointing to the opposite regarding the trade-offs thing. Just the countries that spend more on their military, either per capita or per, regular dollar amount, are less secure. I can also point to studies showing that, stationing U.S. troops abroad increases the chance of attacks against them abroad and against the U.S. homeland. So I can point to studies like that too. It's just there's no empirical backing for spending more on the military. It's just all ideological and all interest driven, in my opinion.
When we were talking about the State Department, Stephen Semler, you mentioned so-called military aid. I had some guests on this program many weeks back. We did a whole show about the fact that the U.S. spends more on other countries' militaries than on addressing the climate. Sound right to you? I mean, there's the U.S. puts a significant amount of money into other people's militaries, and I would be surprised if 1% of the US public even knew that.
Yeah, in terms of, I mean, to me, that sounds like a National Priorities Project Lindsay Kashkarian kind of study, where she
That
that because that's
wasn't the
not,
guess, but yes, very much. Yeah,
but
tradition.
yeah, to me, I mean, if you compare U.S. military to other countries compared to like international climate investments, I mean, the results are just staggering. Even if you compare the total amount of military aid to the U.S.'s own climate investments, like the real kind, not like building a wall to prevent a wave from crashing into a city, but like actual climate mitigation. Yeah, the extent to which we arm foreign militaries is really out of control. And another thing that a caveat is that a lot of that aid, about half of that military aid, comes from the Pentagon budget. So when people complain about foreign aid and that sort of thing, first off, they usually exclude military aid as the Trump department, as the Trump administration just did with its budget request, they excluded that. But also, they don't talk about the Pentagon budget, even though I think now most of the military aid actually comes from the Pentagon and not the State Department, which has been a shift that's been ongoing since 2006, when the Pentagon first got an authority to run its fund and run its own train and equip so-called authorities in other countries.
If you leave out that 40% or so of US so-called aid that's actually weapons and military training, the US is even less generous toward the rest of the world in comparison to some other countries than it looks like, right? But this blowback of the 5% demand, like the US gets all the other NATO members to get 5% of their economies going into weapons, and then they demand the same of the US. Oh no, it's blown back. Like, isn't that exactly what Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Donald Trump want? Aren't they going to be thrilled with that? Oh, okay, we'll have to do that too. Oh no, don't throw me in that briar patch. Like, isn't that like Lockheed Martin's dream come true?
But I mean, just looking at Lockheed Martin's annual contract revenue, at least in 2023, was about $70 billion, which was most than several entire federal agencies' budget. So Lockheed Martin got more from the Pentagon than some federal agencies got overall. The amount of capital that's flowing to Lockheed Martin and those other top firms, Raytheon, now RTX, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, it's really absurd. For a forthcoming paper I'm writing for Brown University's Cost of War project, sneak preview of one of the findings, two of those top five firms over the last 5 years, they got $770 billion in Pentagon contracts, which is wild. Compare that to Biden's famous infrastructure bill, which obligated or gave budget authority to $548 billion. So we're talking over $200 billion more to five companies than were devoted to this historic flagship infrastructure bill that supposedly defined Biden's legacy. Although I think Biden's legacy is defined by something else, but
that's over a period of years, right? But the top five weapons companies, yeah, they get that again the next year and the next year and the next year, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that $770 billion was a collection of the five companies over 5 years, but that $70 billion I mentioned first, that's every year. I'll tell you another company that's really excited about that, that, you know, pegging 5% of GDP to military spending, are like the new tech bros that are now entering the military space, specifically Elon Musk. The Air Force Secretary nominee that Elon was personally pushing for, who funneled contracts basically at the NRO to Elon Musk, allegedly based on numerous reports from inside NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, and who Elon Musk personally sat in on the interview with Donald Trump for this Air Force secretary. His last name's Mink, I think, M-E-I-N-K. I don't know how to pronounce it. But he was confirmed this week, and 21 Democrats voted with Republicans to confirm him. Yeah. And a handful of Republicans voted no as well. So, as you know, military spending is a bipartisan problem, because they're both beholden to the same masters, like Lockheed Martin.
Indeed. I mean, I wanted to ask you, there's virtually nobody in Congress who pushes back against it. I mean, I'm aware of one senator in recent years, I don't know about this year, but in recent years, Bernie Sanders, who said, I'm going to vote no, I want my colleagues to vote no. This year, I'm aware of Congressman Ro Khanna, who has said, I'm going to vote no on increased military spending, I want my colleagues to vote no. Only two examples in the past decade that I know of, you know, where anybody has said before a vote, I'm going to vote no and my colleagues should too, much less organized a group of Congress members to vote no and vote no on every procedural vote and try to actually get military spending reduced. Instead, you have, I mean, it's a serious topic, but it seems a shade ridiculous, this legislation to cut $100 billion that people co-sponsor, even while allowing the budget for military to go up more than $100 billion every year. Like, what is going on there? Are we being scammed even by the very best members of Congress? Are they actually trying to resist military spending increases?
I think the problem with advocacy now is that it's so confined to professional advocacy circles. And I think part of the problem is with the legislation being offered. It's just a $100 billion cut, but it doesn't say where the cuts go. So busy working people who have already a ton to work about, like, two-thirds of people live paycheck to paycheck, and people have problems with that measure, but I think it's pretty good, actually, because, you know, it rises up and down with, like, the number of people actually facing financial hardship, which is about 4 in 10 Americans, about 40%. That legislation that's being put forward doesn't lean into the main strength that military spending advocates have, which is at least the most immediate strength, which is what that money could go for instead, the opportunity cost, the guns versus butter. Right now, the guns versus butter discussion is stuck in this, it's cordoned off into a theoretical discussion. So as a result, that legislation doesn't incentivize public participation. So even if you have someone who agrees with you and agrees that the Pentagon budget should be cut, they've no incentive to take time out of their busy lives to, you know, call their congressman or do something small like that, even, because they have so much other stuff to worry about.
Can you, in one piece of legislation, take money out of here and put it into there? And even if you could, if the military budget keeps going up, 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 isn't it still a little ridiculous to be doing that?
For me, I think, like, all options are on the table, like stopping it, you using procedural votes, like voting on the rule before like allowing debate. You can extend a debate indefinitely, filibuster, which I think is cool. I think though that there is an option legislatively that could spur more public interest in it, that would put pressure on the members of Congress who are interested in reducing military spending, like actually to take it a bit more seriously and be a bit more invested in it, and also pressure the members of Congress who just kind of vote for it out of habit. And there is legislation that could, I mean, I actually wrote legislation that would do this, where it would reduce the Pentagon budget by $150 billion and use those savings, the money that would have been spent, towards another round of those $600 relief checks that were issued in January 2021 that reached 236 million people. Now, I'm not going to tell you the name of the legislation because I named it after myself as a joke. I used my name as an act, the Stopping Taxpayer Exploitation by the Pentagon to Help Everyone's Needs and Security Act, or Stevens Act. So I'm working with a couple groups now to maybe get that on the table. But I think that is basically, if that gets on the table, potentially, we're effectively saying to the general public, look, help us cut the Pentagon budget because it's the right thing to do morally. It's the smart thing to do strategically. And if we're successful, you and your spouse and your kid will get $600, provided that, you qualify. You're not like super rich or whatever. But to me, that's the direction that the legislation should be going. Now, regarding the other stuff you mentioned, regarding like voting on rules and stating early a commitment to vote against military spending and doing that sort of thing, I think that has to be part of it too. But what's bothering me the most personally is just that the legislation right now just kind of seems like a dead rout.
I love your legislative idea. I think it's an improvement on the existing bill. I just don't want to go around applauding Congress members for co-sponsoring that while they lie back and allow military spending to go up by more than $150 billion, and they're getting credit for this bill that in theory would cut it by $150 billion. It seems counterproductive overall.
Some extent, but this one would be a rescissions bill. I mean, it would be instituted after, and it would be, rescind the money that was already spent. But, again, runs into the same problem you identified. It's that theoretically a member of Congress could vote for the military budget to increase and then vote for this thing to decrease it again. But right now, I just view it as I compare it to a baseline where the military spending is just going to keep going up and up. And I don't see, aside from the legislation I wrote, any sort of actual technical mechanism to bring it down. So that's pretty much where I'm at.
Well, I would love to see such legislation passed. I'd also love to see a serious effort by Congress members to stop the military spending bill unless it's reduced. But
Right.
we'll have to keep working for both. Stephen Semler is a senior fellow at Center for International Policy, author of Polygraph, a newsletter on Substack. You can find it at stephensemler.com. Stephen, thanks for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks, David.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.